Hello, everyone. Hi. What's up? It's me, Rob. It's just me again. I hope that's okay. Don't turn off the episode, okay? Don't turn this off. Leave it on. As I mentioned in the previous episode, Jordan's away this week, so I'm holding down the fort solo. But I think we've been churning out some good episodes here. Earlier this week, I talked to Nima Shirazi of the Citations Needed podcast, and that was a fantastic conversation about the Iranian counterattack that we saw over last weekend. I really encourage people to check that out. Normally, those are bonus episodes for our beloved paid interns. I did unlock this one because it seemed like a pertinent conversation that I thought more people should hear. So if you haven't got a chance to check that one out, please give that a listen. It was really tremendous. And today I'm talking to Prem Tucker, a politics reporter from The Intercept. We talked a little bit about whatever happened last night with this Israel counterattack that got reported like it was the beginning of World War III and then kind of got walked back. It was kind of very alarming and confusing. We talked a little bit about that. And also, Prem's been doing a lot of really quality reporting on the activism that's been going on college and university campuses in the United States, particularly Columbia University, where yesterday you had the NYPD rolling into Columbia and arresting a bunch of these student protesters at this solidarity encampment at Columbia, including Isra Hirsi, who's Ilhan Omar's daughter and actually a former guest of this show. So solidarity with Isra and every other activist that's at Columbia right now. Interestingly as well, I didn't get a chance to mention this with Prem, but the NYPD ended up putting out this kind of letter that totally threw Columbia and Columbia President Minouz Shafik kind of totally under the bus, basically saying, hey, we're here because we got called in, but we didn't assess any immediate threat or anything like that. So you have this kind of tension between the NYPD, who basically showed up as armed thugs to disrupt this protest at the behest of the university, while simultaneously kind of trying to distance themselves from that. Very strange. But overall, just over the last 6 months, there's been so much coverage of college and university activists and their sayings and phrases and, you know, making Israel supporting students feel uncomfortable and kind of policing these pro-Palestine movements. You know, this is not just exclusive to college campuses, but this has been kind of like ground zero for this kind of discourse. And there's been this growing tension between the violence that we've been seeing in Gaza for now 6 straight months with this nonstop obsession with college activism. This is something I spoke to Prem Tucker about, and it was a really great conversation. Before we get to Prem, please do, if you can, subscribe to the Insurgents podcast, the podcast that you're listening to right now at this very moment. We really, really appreciate all the support we get from our listeners. Really, the only way we're able to keep doing this podcast and churning out 2 episodes a week of this podcast week after week after week is because some of you fine, upstanding individuals have been supporting the work that we do. We appreciate it so much, but we need all the help we can get continuing to do this show. So if you can, please do subscribe and support this podcast at insurgentspod.com. That's my pitch. Let's get to The Intercept's Prem Tucker. Again, a really fantastic conversation. He's going to be joining the show right after this. And now we are joined by Prem Tucker, a politics reporter for The Intercept, author of the newsletter Better World. Prem, how's it going? Thank you so much for joining the show.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. The Better World newsletter, that's got to be kind of more difficult to make the case lately over the last couple of months than maybe previously. But
definitely more and more. But I mean, As long as there's hope to be had, someone's got to be sharing it, and there's a lot of people that feel it too. So,
What is it? Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the spirit,
that's
something along
right.
those
Yeah,
lines.
something along those
I
lines.
probably butchered
And
that.
we lean into the latter regardless.
Good. I think we need more of that. So the main reason I reached out, Ram, is I know you've been covering what's been happening at Columbia over the last days and weeks. I just wanted to, before we got into that, just ask what your thoughts were with this the situation last night with Iran and Israel. Of course, over the weekend we had Iran launching these drone and missile strikes into Israel with these military targets. No casualties was heavily kind of telegraphed ahead of time. They considered the matter concluded. Israel was insisting that they were intending to respond to that. And then there was a kind of a scary moment last night where there was all kinds of reporting about multiple strikes in Iran on nuclear sites. And then it turned out to be not quite as serious as that. It's kind of a, it's been a little bit of a confusing situation and also scary because of how fraught everything is and how much of a powder keg the entire region is. Like, what were your thoughts on that last night?
Yeah, that was interesting because, Iran's initial counterattack after, they were first attacked upon by Israel on April 1st, for on their consulate building in Damascus. Their counterattack, as as alluded to, was pretty telegraphed. It seemed very much about showing deterrence, showing will to deter, for, domestic and regional reasons, to show that, if they wanted to, they would. Kind of thing. And then for Israel to then counterattack, regardless of the scale, was something that, like, many experts obviously say is not smart. If they were wanted to be rational actors or even just good faith actors with their partners such as the US, nevertheless they did. And that counterattack didn't seem to be, fortunately, as destructive, at least so far, as it was feared that it could have been, is confusing just insofar as it's like, okay, why do you really need to prove deterrence if you started this? And if it's just about, like, domestically showing, their will, I mean, they have been doing that for the past 6 months to any of their constituents that care about how much of an iron fist they're going to throw at, I guess, any Arab in the region, if they so choose. So it's confusing in that respect. It's also just, I think, underscores how many of the adjectives people in the political establishment throw towards Iran about being, unruly, about being, unaccountable, a dangerous nuclear power, conceivably, is in many respects, Israel, particularly given the fact that we give them, or the US rather, gives them so much money, that sort of structural incongruency between them and Iran in terms of those descriptors is all the more, relevant, because it's not like America gives Iran billions of dollars every year. And nevertheless, in some respects, with regards to the past few weeks, you could say that Iran has behaved with more, a higher temperament than Israel. Or one could make that argument. So those were my thoughts. I mean, one other thing was just that it was so poetic for Israel to go ahead to do this. I know that, the US in the recent, 48 to 72 hours had gotten hints that perhaps this would have happened, or that Israel was planning to do this. But that had happened the same day that America did Israel, another solid by vetoing the UN resolution that would have allowed Palestine to join the UN. That seemed just like a pretty emblematic 1-2 punch of all this.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that came up on my conversation with Nima Shirazi earlier this week, where we talked about this discrepancy in the way that Iran is framed in our media and political discourse as being this rogue, criminal, terrorist regime, While in a lot of cases, especially recently, you have Iran like working within the confines of international law, trying to use the UN, trying to use these kind of institutions. And meanwhile, you have Israel just flagrantly ignoring and violating, the ICJ, the UN, and the way these two things are talked about, it's really completely backwards.
And that point doesn't even require, because of course some people take that to be, oh, you're shilling for Iran. It's like, no, I mean, you're just re reporting things as they have been and as they are, which is to say, to your point, in respects to certain things, Iran is just working within the framework of international law or trying their best to minimize escalation or heightening tensions, whereas Israel clearly is not doing that. And that's just sort of sky's blue kind of observation.
Yeah, I mean, as I've been talking about a lot lately, it's not really about supporting Iran or whitewashing anything about Iran that you might criticize, but it's just there's kind of a stark line right now between a country that's just like completely out of control and engaged in this ongoing genocide, and then you have this other country that's meaningfully and materially trying to stop that from happening. So it doesn't mean that you support every single thing that might happen in this country, but it's just pointing out reality when you kind of talk about that discrepancy. It's interesting this UN vote too as well. It's like, and I haven't looked yet at their actual justification for this vote. I was kind of planning on doing that in more of a live setting, but it is really fascinating when you have this, like, it's been multiple decades of the US government and politicians, including Joe Biden, saying two-state solution. I believe in a two-state solution. And that's kind of like what politicians just have learned to just say in order to kind of shut down whatever criticism or shut down, any kind of difficult questions they have to ask about supporting Israel. Two-state solution. But then, like, when this comes up at the UN, you have the US again using their veto power to prevent that from happening. And like from what you've been paying attention to, like how do they square this circle between this constant refrain about how they support this two-state solution while literally being the one country to prevent that from ever really materializing? Of course, except Israel, who's been building settlements and making that pretty much impossible for the last several decades.
For those who might have missed this, my colleague Ken Clipperton, he had a great story on this that showed leaked cables that kind of reiterated, I should say Ken and Dan Bogusław, they both collaborated on the story, that revealed leaked cables from, I believe it was the State Department, I think, that reiterated kind of the line that the State Department, the administration has been kind of using to square the circle for a while now, which is that they believe that the most sort of expeditious path towards harmony, towards actualization for Palestinians is through normalization between Israel and its neighbors. This kind of, just amorphous statement about working with partners in the region, working with Israel to normalize relations and create a Palestinian state. Which is, I mean, pretty much just the functional equivalent of there's always next week, And of course, next week never comes. Well, what does that even mean, to want to broker such a thing when, I mean, insofar as even the United States' efforts to broker a ceasefire, that has shown thus far to be pretty not fruitful. And I mean, just as a small tangent to that, obviously one particular sticking point with regards to those negotiations and with partners in the region is that Hamas ostensibly just wants a total ceasefire and a, complete exchange of hostages and Palestinians detained as well and so on, and just a sort of like full-formed way of kind of moving forward. Whereas over and over again, the supposed great offers helped brokered by the US involve, weeks, 6 weeks, X weeks amount of ceasefire, all while the US is still maintaining openness to attack Israel attacking Rafah, which I don't know about you, but I think a ceasefire would not include an openness to that. But I think that sort of example shows how sincere a more broader desire for brokering such a deal would be, which is to say, if you're brokering a ceasefire, which is really functionally a temporary pause, and you're also describing aspirations to help bring together partners to bring about a Palestinian state, what would that even look like? I mean, we've seen examples of that already with some members of Congress, some in the government, and some, you know, just in the political sphere, talking about a demilitarized Palestinian state, et cetera, where, which means, you know, what other state is described in such a way where you're pretty much still describing a people that are subject to others around them? This is just the current situation, maybe with friendlier terms, like, oh, well, they have their own land officially now. So it's things like that that I think embody how sincere a statement like that means. Because, of course, it seems like one good step towards leveraging partners in the region, such as Israel, to begin to entertain these conversations is to welcome Palestine into the United Nations. So those are my thoughts on their decision this week. And of course, it did not come as a surprise, but I think just given more of the world seeing how the U.S. has operated on the UN in the past 6 months, I think there's obviously a more concentrated focus on how they would vote here.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just one of the biggest discrepancies as well, is there's all these kind of preconditions for what a Palestinian state might look like. And you mentioned like this kind of demilitarized state that's maybe slightly more official than it currently is, while keeping the same, more or less the same status quo intact. I feel like it's strange, like in both politics and the media, what never really seems to come up when these discussions happen is that Israel just seems to have no interest whatsoever in having any kind of two-state solution. They've made this pretty abundantly clear in their words, in like the Likud charter, in these, like, that's what this whole decades of building these illegal settlements has been about making that completely untenable and impossible. So it's still a little jarring, I think, to hear Western politicians, either in America, the United States or Canada or wherever else, talk about this possibility and talk about all the roadblocks and obstacles and basically putting the onus on Palestinians for that, while ignoring that their close allies, the closest allies that they have in the world don't seem to have any interest whatsoever in that ever being any kind of an outcome, even in this kind of like watered down version that they're proposing.
Yeah. Right on.
Another incident of the UN, or the United States wielding its power in the UN to make it essentially, more or less this symbolic organization with no real ability to do anything, especially after a few weeks ago when they passed finally that ceasefire resolution, which the U.S. immediately said was non-binding, which is like a first, just making stuff up as they go along. So yet another example of the U.S. kind of wielding its power in the U.N., which, you know, it makes it difficult for it to fulfill any of the functions that it's supposed to have.
One thing I note on that, just before we move on, is that,
no, go ahead.
Of course, that passed by the U.S. just for once deciding not to veto it, which is already, you know, kind of amusing.
Yeah.
That, you know, the threshold is, the U.S. didn't veto something. It passed. How exciting. And I remember there was, you know, so many headlines about, you know, this was the first time the U.S. hasn't vetoed this kind of thing, you know, in X time. And it's like, man, this is the bar. But also, you know, the fact that it's now been, I mean, months ago, I don't even remember when exactly this was, because, you know, things just keep happening. But just days before the Michigan primary, where President Biden was asked about, you know, the status of ceasefire negotiations, and he suggested that there would be one to come in perhaps even days. Here we are now. That I think that has kind of been brushed away as just, you know, of course, just another moment of absurdity in hindsight. But that happened, I think it was a day or two before the Michigan primaries. I assume it might have just been colloquial, but like functionally, perhaps as a way to temper the uncommitted
vote.
Oh,
absolutely.
But yeah, that just came to mind.
Well, that's just been the absurd thing about the last 6 months is that like they're still doing this strategy of saying, oh, all the tough, difficult conversations we've been having. Biden, we heard leaks that Biden is just so angry and upset behind the scenes as they just repeatedly continue to arm and fund Israel, continuing to use whatever diplomatic leverage they have at the UN or in any of these institutions to ensure that there's zero consequences for anything that they're doing. But they're having all these tough, difficult conversations behind the scenes, and they're still trying to like sell this to people like it means something. It's kind of amazing. It's become almost like comical at this point that they're still trying this.
Yeah. And conceivably, behind closed doors, he could be very fierce, but I think it's just as likely that he's reacting in such a way because he or the people around him are just so confused why people are mad at them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, this is all just conjecture, but it is just like remarkable to see, both given the actual calamity that we're seeing, but also the potential electoral stakes. And of course, thirdly, all those wrapped up together, that despite all of that and all the mounting evidence that this hurts politically, that this hurts morally, that this hurts in terms of the US image across the world, that overall, they haven't substantially changed paths too much. And that suggests either that they just care very much about, you know, the positions they've staked, or they just are so radically confused by and don't believe those stakes, that they don't believe that it'll be as bad as people make it out to be, which means that they're just kind of in an echo chamber. So because of those reasons, they could be angry, but not because, you know, they're really trying to work it over with Israel, but they're just so just intimately and viscerally confused and frustrated and unsure about why people are so mad at them. I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
that's just if there is any way to validate those stories in the first place, because to your point, the actual explanation doesn't carry much weight if their actions stay the same.
No. And, I think that that's an explanation that does make a lot of sense, even if it is kind of conjecture. But I also think that that's a good way to get into this current situation with what's happening at Columbia and across, campuses, you know, across Canada and the United States. Because I think ultimately what we're seeing here is this a disconnect between these kind of like powerful people in politics, in the media, in academia, and this increasing growing divide between these people and, you know, average people and what they want. Not just like, you know, average Democratic Party voters who are often like have pretty strong feelings about wanting to have a ceasefire and not wanting the Democrats to continue to arm and fund Israel while they do this. But so you're seeing this play out on elite university campuses, you know, including Columbia right now. So do you just want to like, I know you've been doing a lot of coverage and reporting on this. Do you just want to maybe recap the last week or so of events of what's been happening at Columbia? I know they sent in the NYPD yesterday to this encampment yesterday. They've been arresting students. It's really kind of like a tense situation that seems like it could continue to develop. So yeah, do you want to like let us know like what's been happening there?
Yeah. So on Wednesday, Columbia President Manoush Shafiq and two board co-chairs of the Board of Trustees, as well as a faculty member, or former faculty member, former dean, I should say, who helps lead the school's task force on antisemitism, were called to Congress to testify in front of the House Committee on Workforce and Education, I believe is what it's called, which famously held a hearing, you know, a few months ago with some other Ivy League presidents, leading to the resignation or pushing out of Harvard and Penn's presidents. So this hearing was kind of a widely anticipated sequel to that, to see if Columbia also would fall for the traps or to what extent they would. And the hearing was specifically about Columbia's response to anti-Semitism, which the hearing was presupposing that it was poor, that the campus was in crisis because Columbia wasn't doing enough to meet concerns of anti-Semitism and implicitly to shut down protesters. We wrote a story in the lead up to the hearing, which pretty much previewed the hearing and talked about how ahead of it, you know, Colombia had sort of started to ramp up its suppression of pro-Palestinian students and faculty, along with other schools as well, Vanderbilt, Pomona, and other schools as well. Obviously, the context of that being that these schools are continuing what we've seen over the past 6 months, which is just bringing the hammer down on students and student activists, student protesters, but all the more so because this was after Israel killed those 7 World Central Kitchen workers. So on one hand, you see the political establishment begin to, you know, warm up to the idea that we should maybe think about this whole conflict maybe in a different light. But then these colleges were kind of doubling down on things in a lot of ways. So that was sort of the pretext for this. This week, in the hours before the hearing, hundreds of students at Columbia took to the lawns on the main campus to set up an encampment. And the encampment was, on one hand, sort of an ode to the hearing to come, which, as many predicted, was essentially in a lot of ways functionally a placation to a lot of faulty premises that a lot of these committee members had, especially, you know, members like Elise Stefanik, who it's particularly interesting to see them be sort of crusaders against anti-Semitism when they, of course, have said little to nothing about avid rank anti-Semitism among their own party, of course, among Donald Trump specifically. But regardless of that tangent, that's how the hearing sort of went. And so throughout the day, this encampment only grew in numbers and size. Not only were they speaking out against the hearing, but particularly they were really ramping up ongoing calls for years at this campus about divestment and financial transparency, divestment from companies that are implicated in Israel's violence in Palestine. I'll also note that there were numerous divestment votes at the university in different schools, especially Columbia College and Barnard, where two of the four main undergraduate schools that have in large margins voted in support of divesting. And of course, it's not a surprise that Columbia, like many other schools, have chosen not to heed that, especially because those are, of course, not every single school that the university, you know, represents. But nevertheless, there have been some schools that have at least made overtures or at least moved towards more transparency about their investments. Columbia has thus far not done any of that. So that was the beginning of this encampment, and it stretched on for hours and hours into another day, into, you know, there's students still out there. So I guess, you know, at this point, it's 2 days worth of students being active. But on Thursday, after Columbia President Shafiq and the other three had testified in front of Congress and pretty much in different ways made commitments to bring the hammer down even more, they fulfilled that promise. Shafiq had authorized the NYPD on Thursday through a very kind of historic letter that I think people should check out. It's this like two-page letter, 1.5-page letter that she addressed to the NYPD, talking about, you know, of course, the challenges that they want to remain a campus that welcomes free speech and so on. Something that Columbia prides itself on because of its historical legacy, which we can talk about.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she felt that, you know, students were repeatedly warned about the various rules that they're breaking, up to the idea that they were beginning to trespass. And thus she determined that now became the need to deploy the NYPD, authorize them to come in to sweep them out. And thus at that point, we then see these truly remarkable images of like dozens and maybe close to 100. I don't know how many police officers from the NYPD, various units as well, pretty much descend upon the lawns at Columbia's campus, to circle around, these protesters with their signs. There's this great video that I post on my Twitter of you can see, all these protesters kind of sitting in a circle with their tents scattered around them. There's a Palestinian flag waving in the wind, kind of prominently in the middle. There's hundreds of students outside the lawns kind of observing, protesting, cheering as well. And then these officers just kind of enter into the bottom of the lawns and descend and get ready to carry out this sweeping. And then, of course, you see, I believe the reports are about 108 students that were then arrested. I believe many of which have been released. But regardless, the school had sicked the city police onto its own students under the justification of maintaining public safety. One thing that I'll note as well that a faculty member had pointed out to me is that Columbia has its own public safety department, and I'm sure that they were surely present, but that Columbia decided, A, you know, to respond with such force at all, but B, to just very quickly choose to authorize the NYPD, which of course has its own litany of issues it's faced, especially recently with regards to how they respond as a police force generally, to authorize them to go and sweep up their own students and arrest their own students, as opposed to trying some mediation with public safety, as opposed to perhaps even meeting these students and working through these demands. You know, the university, as other universities say, like, oh, like we sent out representatives to, you know, express goodwill or to warn them. But, you know, the protesters are there because there are clear demands they're making. And of course, it's not like institutions should always acquiesce to any demand someone makes. That's not the point. But the point is that many of these demands are at its face reasonable ones to engage with regards to if these are students who pay to go here and their money is going into investments, it would maybe be reasonable for them to know where those dollars are going. You know, conversations like that, at least sort of an honest brokerage of those conversations. But instead, what we see here, as we've seen over the past 6 months at many universities, when students call for either divestment or at least financial transparency from their schools, is, you know, dismissal, ignoring them until it bubbles up where, you know, their protests get more and more dramatic to the point of then the schools can say, oh, well, we had to call the police because they were breaking rules. But then up to that point, the university often had not engaged in good faith with those demands in the first place.
It was such a kind of jarring example of this kind of double speak in this letter from Minush Shafiq. Like you've alluded to this, referencing and kind of celebrating the history of protest and activism at Columbia at the exact same time as justifying, you know, calling in these armed thugs in the NYPD to break up this encampment. It's really kind of incredible, this dichotomy. And it really speaks to this tendency, I think, with the kind of like liberal class to sort of like retroactively support and sometimes co-opt movements for social or racial justice or civil rights in the past, but then when these movements are happening currently, not supporting them. And in fact, you know, siding with the status quo and kind of trying to undermine and destroy them. I just thought that was the most amazing thing about this letter is at the same, as while you simultaneously celebrate this legacy while calling in the NYPD to bust up this encampment. It's really kind of an incredible moment.
Yeah. That reminds me, I think I saw someone tweet this a few weeks or months ago, and this isn't just about President Shafiq. This is I think, a more broad critique about how, I believe they used the word liberals or the liberal establishment, I don't remember, but the idea was liberals were against every war except the one that's going on right now. And I thought that was, of course, you know, perhaps whatever, a generalization, but like generally like a pretty funny and apt observation. But two, more seriously, I think one thing that's worth considering as well is, of course, the identity aspect of this. Like on one hand, you know, Minush Shafiq was celebrated as, you know, the first, you know, Arab woman president of such a elite institution, one that has obviously had its own issues throughout its history, like with many American institutions with race and identity. And of course, on one hand, you know, here we see, as with many other institutions, such as the UN, for instance, in the past 6 months, how identity can only take you so far. And on the other hand, of course, you know, it would be remiss not to acknowledge the idea that if you are Minush Shafiq, regardless of her own personal background in terms of her ideology, just the fact that she is an Arab woman who is in this position of Egyptian descent means that, of course, in certain respects, like, there's probably this impulse she has, maybe. I mean, I'm not going to psychoanalyze or ascribe any certainty, but, like, it's conceivable to imagine, like, the impulse of her feeling like she needs to respond more affirmatively, more heavily, and acquiesce further because, you know, she needs to earn this position, or she needs to, you know, evade attacks by very pro-Israel or far-right interests, such as, of course, this House committee. And on one hand, you know, you have to reckon with and empathize with that possibility that that might be an impulse. On the other hand, you know, you could imagine, for instance, the other value of identity and diversity of opinion, which is to say that the status quo, the way things are, it remains unchallenged until someone else with a different idea of how things could work comes into a role of power and introduces those different ideas. And so, for instance, here, let's say, you know, you could imagine a counterfactual. Of course, this is a high expectation to have on anyone, but you could imagine a counterfactual in which the Colombian administrators, especially President Shafiq, came to this hearing this Wednesday. And, you know, in some ways, you know, she would try to bat away the questions and then, you know, give the answers that they needed to avoid, you know, any drama. But on the other hand, maybe say, you know, Representative Stefanik, like, I don't know if you're the correct purveyor for some of these questions, especially if you're the one coming after me so hard. I mean, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on Donald Trump. You know, of course, those are, you know, neither here nor there. We can always imagine people to be who we want them to be, et cetera. But you could just imagine a counterfactual in which even someone like President Shafiq, who might be in a harder position because of our identity, took a different approach. Because there are questions to wonder if, regardless how long an administrator like Shafiq will last, given just the degree and magnitude of how challenging this is to oversee as an administrator, particularly in America, where there are so many forces coming at you, regardless of how much you placate them. So those, I think, are just things worth chewing on for all of us as we observe this, both of, you know, understanding the limitations and also the structural forces that surround maybe the people that create these limitations at all.
Yeah, like it's getting a little off topic, but it is something I think about a lot, the way that, like, you know, in politics or media or academia or the private sector, you know, there's this effort to, like, diversify all these institutions, which is something that people should support.
People
from different backgrounds should have voices and places in all these institutions. But what seems to happen a lot is that these people and their identity is kind of, like, weaponized in a way to shield these very powerful institutions from criticism while they carry out the exact same sort of status quo that they were previously. Like, I think a lot about White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, who's a Haitian woman, and she's out there, you know, spinning this genocide that the United States is supporting in Palestine. And, you know, of course, like, over part of an administration that's deporting Haitian migrants en masse and has contributed to destabilization and awful things happening in Haiti for decades. So just shows how this kind of, like, diversity is not really enough in and of itself, if nothing actually but these institutions is really meaningfully being challenged in any way.
Yeah. And Ryan Grimm, my colleague as well, he, I believe, pointed out a few weeks or months ago as well that Ms. Jean-Pierre, she before her job was in the White House, was also quite outspoken on the Israeli government as well. So I think that gets to the broader point as well of just not only is it weaponized, but it's just kind of a shame to see people who probably do have different and interesting and sharp perspectives to bring because of their backgrounds themselves kind of self-censor or in certain ways, because, of course, on one hand, you know, people just want to have a good job and a job nonetheless. But that really just waters down why it's important to have diversity at all. The point is so these different perspectives are heard. But as you say, if they're just weaponized, that eliminates the whole value of it at all.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of it, like, weaponizing identity and diversity, I think it's something very sinister about the last 6 months is the way this concept of anti-Semitism has been weaponized for a very specific kind of, like, ideological purpose. And it's been really jarring over the last 6 months, seeing the level of violence and depravity that we've seen in Gaza. And it feels like the more outraged people are about that, and the more, like, if we're, you know, it's just horror upon horror day after day. And the more people are outraged about this, the more we're hearing about the threat and the danger of anti-Semitism on college campuses or in protests on the street or anywhere else. And, you know, it's just jarring. It's jarring to see this disconnect. Like, I don't know if you've seen that Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby, which is a really interesting kind of expose on how the Israeli lobby works and functions. And college and university campuses are kind of ground zero for this. And you see in the past, like, whenever there's been, you know, Palestinian activism, like throughout any kind of, like, you know, the Gaza war or the Great March of Return, or, you know, a year or two ago with the stuff that was happening in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood that resulted in more bombings, and there was more activism. And anytime there's this kind of flare up of activism, there's this real concerted effort to call attention to this dangerous, like, anti-Semitism on these college campuses. And I think it's just, it's been really jarring for people, because as this disconnect grows, this, like, tension grows between the violence that we're seeing and this fixation on pro-Palestinian activists and framing their activism as somehow inherently harmful or inherently racist or anti-Semitic, these calls to ban certain words and phrases. In Canada, actually, the Canadian example, in the Ontario legislature, they just banned representatives from wearing a kufiya, as, like, in the legislature. And it's like, the more our own governments are subsidizing this, like, brutal violence, the more we're fixating on these kind of, like, words and symbols that, and kind of trying to imbue them with this meaning that they don't even necessarily have. And it just feels like, as that disconnect grows, that tension grows, it's becoming less and less effective. I think it's becoming more difficult to convince people that this is some kind of serious problem, when we see, like, any average person can see, like, what these college activists are standing up against and trying to support, versus, like, what these accusations are. It just seems like it's becoming less and less effective the more this tension grows between the reality in Gaza and the reality on these college campuses.
Yeah. What you're describing, which, very well put, it reminds me of a question that a lot of pro-Israeli people, a lot of Republicans especially, conservative Democrats bring up, which is, you know, well, why do all these people focus so much on Israel? There are lots of countries you could go after. And I think, broadly speaking, I thought there was, you know, a range of issues with the question. Of course, being just how much money we give to Israel, how long this has been going on of us giving money to Israel, and various other reasons. Of course, just being people can focus on many things at once. But C, I think one of the other tertiary reasons why I think more and more people are focusing on this even more is kind of this cumulative effect that you're kind of gesturing towards, insofar as people have been protesting this for a while, of course, for years and years and years, but particularly in the past few years, as we've seen more and more people become concerned with this issue and the images they see in Palestine and Gaza and the West Bank, and even, of course, in Israel, of how Arabs and Palestinians are treated there, the more people have become aware of it, the more people have become concerned with it, the more people have connected the dots with, insofar as, you know, how this has functioned, how this has come to be, the history of the conflict, the history of America's role in it. And then seeing in the ensuing response by the institutions of power in trying to suppress and trying to discredit that concern, which is to say, these protesters, as this protest movement grows, and then the more they grow, the more that they're suppressed, the more that they're attacked, the more that they're labeled as anti-Semitic for fielding these very valid criticisms. I think the cumulative effect of that is that more and more and more people begin to see these contradictions. And as we've seen over and over again, especially in the past 4 years, as the contradictions in American and Western society heighten, more and more and more people become interested in these contradictions and concerned with them, which is why now we're seeing, I think if you had told people a year ago that this many people across the world, and especially this many people in America, would be not only thinking about or talking about Israel-Palestine, but actively going to the streets, actively making phone calls, actively considering how this impacts their vote. People would ask you what took place to have such a scenario happen. And so I think, to your point, the more that these contradictions continue to increase, the more that these very valid criticisms of the Israeli government are fielded, but then are met with politicians just continually calling it anti-Semitic to make those criticisms, and then acting upon that by arresting these people, by suppressing them, by even threatening them in many ways, the more people will believe in this cause and believe in the fact that there is something structurally not right here, that these people that I'm, if I'm even a bystander, that these people that I'm watching are making these seemingly, you know, valid criticisms, but then are met with this kind of resistance. Well, that makes me want to potentially join them too. So that's a dynamic that I think is kind of underrated throughout the past 6 months, of just people coming to understand this issue in various ways. And that is one of them. And one other thing I'll just say that is just that that contributes to these contradictions is we wrote a story a few weeks ago about just all the vicious things that various members of Congress, especially Republicans, have said about Palestine in the past 6 months, and how that has gone on unabated, both by, of course, Congress in terms of censors, but also in the political media establishment in terms of Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar can say one thing that maybe could have been delivered better or is just completely misinterpreted in bad faith. And that'll be talked about for a month by, you know, every magazine, every cable news outlet. These Republicans can say, we want to flatten Gaza, we want to turn into a parking lot, we should kill them all, et cetera, et cetera. And it'll be talked about maybe for a couple of days by independent media, by some cable news outlets for maybe a few segments. But that's about it. And then we move on because, yeah, I don't know, it's just to be expected, or because they're not held to not just the same standard, but a higher standard. Because these things, you don't need to take out of context. You don't need to take into bad faith to prescribe viciousness to them. Yeah. There's no ambiguity in saying we should flatten Gaza, or Representative Brian Mast comparing innocent Palestinian civilians to Nazis. There's no ambiguity in that. And yet much of the mainstream media will, yeah, more so in the past 6 months, talk about it for a little bit, but that's it. There's no wall-to-wall coverage. There's no sort of concern whether this party has gone too far, whether they are out of touch. It's just sort of maybe subsumed into this broader MAGA Republican narrative, but it's never directly about their comments about fellow human beings' right to be human beings, which is always the case if Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib says something that's taken out of context or misinterpreted willfully. That is immediately taken by these same sources as existential threats to Jewish people, which very often, if not always, they're not. These representatives are not calling for any elimination of Israelis or Jewish people in the same way that these Republicans are saying, pretty much outwardly, to commit mass war crimes against Palestinian people.
Yeah, no, it shows very clearly who is considered to be a human being with rights, and who is just considered to be basically like worthy of just being cannon fodder, or just don't get the same level of humanity attributed to them. Yeah. And this is reflected in our discourse and in the media, and it's reflected in the policy, like government policy in the United States and Canada and elsewhere. You know, just to go back on that point, you were talking about how, why do people focus on Israel and why not focus on other things? It's like, I think there's an element of that too. You know, there is other situations, violent situations, and people situations around the world where people are being oppressed or what have you. There is a big discrepancy though. Like, for instance, like the previous, like biggest humanitarian disaster prior to this. And even though there is horrible things happening around the world, I think the level of depravity in this, the way it's concentrated on this caged population, I think is uniquely awful and depraved and horrible. But like previously, the largest humanitarian disaster was due to the Saudi blockade and war in Yemen,
yeah,
which of course the United States was also fully supporting and backing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you didn't have U.S. politicians, like you mentioned, Brian Mast, showing up to Congress wearing like Saudi military uniforms and waving Saudi Arabian flags like John Fetterman is doing with the Israeli flag, or suggesting like having big hearings and discourse about anti-Saudi Arabian discourse when people complained about this this awful human rights disaster in Yemen. So there's this huge discrepancy, and I think people pick up on that, right? And that's exactly why we do focus on it, because there is this uniquely sort of symbiotic relationship between the U.S. government and Israel that doesn't exist really with other countries, even when the U.S. is fully backing them militarily and contributing to whatever violent, depraved thing that they're doing. There's this kind of very kind of unique relationship between Israel and the United States and Canada that just doesn't really exist anywhere else.
That's a very good point. I mean, you could, in that way, you could flip the question right back. Well, why are you so focused on it?
Yeah.
In the same way, like, why are you coming to Congress, the halls of the United States Congress, with the foreign government's military uniform? What prompted you to do that?
Yeah.
So that's a really good point.
It's extremely strange. And so just going back to this, the college campuses stuff in Colombia, I think it's just, it's truly just amazing too, because for whatever reason, you know, university college campuses are talked about so much and is used to kind of like drive outrage and sell newspapers or to, you know, put on segments on cable news talking about woke college kids and what they're doing now. And this it's usually there's this obsession with like free speech. These woke college kids just don't, they want their safe spaces. They don't believe in free speech. And these like grown adults who have nothing to do with it, kind of obsessing and fixating over it. But then you have this case of like, the U.S. government and all these powerful people coming together to like take away the free speech rights of university students in Colombia and elsewhere. And it's just amazing, this kind of dichotomy in the way that these people can simultaneously kind of believe both of these things at the same time.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, you mentioned as well, I guess that's just wondering about what's going to happen in the future. We saw that there was there were these arrests, like you said, a lot of people were released. It seemed to have actually a really galvanizing effect on these student activists who don't seem to be going anywhere. So this situation doesn't seem like it's going to just be resolved right away. There is parallels with, you know, college activism that happened in Colombia and elsewhere in the 60s. And you have another historical parallel, you have the DNC coming up in Chicago. So there are some really interesting historical parallels right now, isn't there, with between like this kind of college activism, the kind of violence that the United States government is subsidizing and supporting right now, and everything seems to be reaching this sort of boiling point. So it is going to be really interesting this throughout the next couple of months to see, you know, where that leads and what that might mean ultimately. Do you agree?
Yeah, completely. I specifically in the context of Colombia, it's interesting because it's April, you know, it's about that time where students are getting ready to perhaps graduate, perhaps just finish up the school year, which means either they're doing finals preparation, final projects, whatever, or they're just relaxing and hanging out, or probably a mix of both. But at Colombia, thousands of students are not doing that. Many because they're out there protesting, some because, you know, they might just be distressed by the whole thing. But there's so many students all on campus, all while Columbia specifically around this time is when they also start building these massive bleacher setups across the entire main campus, where for anyone who has seen the videos and pictures of the protests, those are where they build tons of bleachers for their big graduation ceremony. And so presumably, you know, these kids are in the way of that. And so Colombia does take its ceremony very seriously. So I'm curious what that means in terms of, are they just going to keep suspending students? Are they going to just keep throwing the hammer down? Are they going to maybe try to meet them on some demands, even just superficially, to just try to get out of this mess? I was listening to WKCR yesterday, which is Colombia's radio, which I recommend everyone tuning into. They are so, so good at what they do. I was listening yesterday and they were just on top of it. And you know, of course, this was kind of an unprecedented thing for them, but they were just rolling with it, really doing a great job. And they brought up at one point that every year, Colombia's dining services, they do this surf and turf kind of special event where on the lawns they serve like seafood and all sorts of fancy special dining food. And that was supposed to be yesterday. So I don't know what ended up happening there, but that's just an example. Like Colombia has these sort of stakes of ceremony, let alone stakes of public image that they want to maintain. But they can't just ignore thousands of students who are protesting in such a visible way, especially because to your point, especially amid the arrests, just scrolling online, just seeing the amount of people, both Columbia faculty, but also just people in the media, Columbia alums who are just horrified by what they were seeing, either by their alma mater or just by this school that, you know, they think they maybe revere. It like that matters in terms of public image and public response. So in terms of what Columbia does in even the next 72 hours, I'm not sure. I think to our what we were talking about earlier, it really depends on who's in the room of decision-making in terms of rationality, in terms of self-reflection, even in terms of self-interest in their self-reflection. Like you don't have to be reflective and try to tamper things down because you're genuine. You can just tamper things down in whatever way you can just for your own self-interest. So I think that will really depend on who's in the room. And if President Shafiq, for instance, if she really does have a lot of power here relative to, for instance, the Board of Trustees, whether she'll try to take the reins, whether, again, because I don't know her personal motives, if she does feel conflicted, will she allow herself to, you know, resist these impulses further? Will she double down? Is it her decision? Is there more decision-making coming from the Board of Trustees or other sources? I will say, if anyone's listening and does have information into that, you should definitely leak to me. But yeah, I think a lot of those questions will probably instruct what happens from here. And I think, to your point as well, those decisions, I think, will have certain parallels. At least those questions have parallels to how the DNC and the Democrats respond as well in a few months.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. Prem, I appreciate that you took the time to come on to speak to me about this. You've been doing some fantastic reporting on this over the last couple of weeks. Do you just want to let everyone know where they can find your work before we sign off here?
Thank you. Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Prem_Tucker. And I know it's Tucker, but it's T-H-A-K-K-E-R. I think that's the same thing on Instagram, TikTok, whatever, wherever you do your endless scrolling. But I appreciate you, you know, sharing some time with me. It's very, very kind of you.
Yeah, of course. Great discussion. I appreciate you coming on to speak to us all about this. Prem, thanks a lot. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.